And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You are about to hear an announcement of a new technology that will change the world. From the dread of oil to the hope of solar. Energy Light. When we return, we bring you the clear path to a sustainable world as the voice of the Earth speaks through the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Has there ever been a time when the weather has so dominated the news? Here in Southern California, we are experiencing a relentless rain that has turned our normally sublime lives into a torrent of threats from collapsing hillsides, sudden sinkholes, ravaged roadways, and on the bright side, reservoirs once again bulging with water. Is this just a coincidence, or is there a bigger story? In the U.S., we are still playing make-believe with our future, as we are still arguing whether climate change is really just those nature wackos trying to scare us to think us into considering alternative energies. Meanwhile, in Europe, Japan, and China, whole nations are building economies on new technologies. So, no better time than right now to let you know about a new solar technology that is about to change the way we think of the word alternative. In our first segment, we talk with John and Inga Lang, two German physicists who have spent the last 20 years of their lives in Southern California applying their genius to invent and forge the breakthrough that the world needs now. It's a solar generation system that takes light leaps ahead of current technologies. I am proud to bring this story, solution, and opportunity to the world. And in our last segment, we head up the coast of Northern California as our National Park of the Week series continues from the Muir Woods National Monument. So after a brief look at the news, the Voice of the Earth brings you answers, hope, and wonder here on the Wildside News. And now, the news. It's a strange story, the murder of a 74-year-old nun who had been active in working to preserve the hardwood-rich forests in Pará State in Brazil. The onslaught of illegal logging threatened not only the ancient Brazilian forests, but the people who called them their homes. The head of Brazil's environmental agency has announced a dramatic crackdown on illegal loggers and ranchers as a result of her death. Brazil created vast environmental reserves and sent its army of federal police to fight deforestation last week after international outrage at the murder of prominent U.S. human rights activist Dorothy Stang. Luis Fernando Krieger Marico, interim president of Brazil's environmental agency, declared, "This is the turning point. There will be a noticeable fall in deforestation between 2004 and 2005. This decline will be progressive from now on." It is a sad but worthy tribute to a brave woman of the Amazon forest. The head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has drafted a memo to all agency personnel stating that he is unhappy with and seeking alternatives to the Bush administration's competitive sourcing program, which is forcing government agencies to put various job categories up for competitive bidding from the private sector. In a recent bid, the 659 U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologists have been placed in competition with the private sector to carry out their field studies and analysis. In a recent email, Director Steve Williams states, "I believe that the Biological Services study needs further consideration. I have recommended to the Assistant Secretary of Policy, Management, and Budget that we terminate the Aquatic Species Husbandry competition and we review the Biological Services study to determine whether we can conduct this competition in a way that meets the goals of the President's management agenda. The process of replacing government employees who conduct field research on rivers, lakes, species, and trends could be considered by some to open the possibility of tainted reports that may try to court favor with existing government administrators." On a similar note, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employee was served with a $3,500 fine by the Department of Justice for rescuing a threatened species of rare Chiricahua leopard frog from circumstances that would lead to their certain destruction. This is the only prosecution on record of a wildlife refuge manager for a conservation-related offense. We will be looking at this story in the weeks ahead. And in New York and San Francisco and other places, the seas are being harnessed with bobbing buoys, submerged turbines, and other systems to harness the extraordinary forces of the sea. The advantages are obvious. It is always there, for starters. It is fairly predictable. Most of the systems are either submerged or float on the surface. Wind turbines become more efficient as humidity increases due to the denser air. Ocean-powered turbines, powered by ocean currents and swells, can therefore harness 1,000 times more energy. Finally, people are beginning to get smart. And that's just the start. And that's the news.
As you both well know, the planet has reached a point where its living systems are really at risk.
In danger.
Those of us who pay attention know that. But for some reason, it's so difficult to get this message out to mainstream Americans. I'd love to know why.
Why? It's very simple. There are too many people who makes a living from energy, from oil sales, oil, and from coal, from all these things. And therefore, it is very difficult to get them away from the source of their income. And therefore, many people, even in government, are not too much enthusiastic about what we are doing. We are colleagues from university. We are both physicists, and we did all things except environment. So we invented new blowers. A tangential blower is my invention. We have 84 licensees like GE, like Nodalco, like Gillette, and so on. And 22 years ago, we decided we stop and we do only solar.
82, we got our first patent on solar in 1982 about solar power plant. But it's a different system than the one we have now. It took us 20 years to get to the simple ones.
The principle is the same.
What made you come up with the decision to focus entirely on solar?
Because wind is something that is close to the shore, on mountains pretty good, but that is an indirect use of solar energy. So we decided solar fits in our field of knowledge. We believe we could make it in 5 years. Then it was 10 years, it was 15 years, and finally, now we are ready. So you have to go to come with us to our test unit in El Cajon that should convince people that this technology is possible. Why? And that is a secret. Two axes following or tracking the sun is very well known. The well-known systems are highly expensive. So we found a way how to get away from this need of high precision. This I want to show you here on an instrument.
Okay, I'm looking at a small device here. It's cast, it looks like, out of aluminum. It has some fins on it and some sort of a square aperture. Oh, and then also a little meter. Very good, yeah. Okay, John is shining a laser beam into this unit, and we're kind of watching to see what happens here. Okay.
You have here, what is it, 16?
Yes.
And the interesting is, it doesn't matter where I bring the beam down. I can go in the corner, I can go in the middle, I can go wherever I want. It is always the same number. And in addition, we developed a new kind of lens, a lens that is not a frontal lens anymore. It is a lens with internal reflection. And that gives us a possibility to make a very short pencil of rays. This very, very short pencil of rays accumulates on a point of only 2.8 millimeter diameter, so a tenth of an inch. This little spot is not bigger than the spot from this laser, but it has a intensity that you can melt metals.
It concentrates the sun to 400 suns in this small point, and that's why it's extremely hot there.
And this focal point of only 2.8 millimeter diameter comes down on our secondary optic, and this point will be spread in such a way that all parts of the cell get the same amount of energy and almost vertical. So we have no losses here anymore. This is the most important invention, and this is the one that gives us the possibility to build a unit that was till now too expensive at a price that can compete with everything else. That means compared with normal systems, let's say with flat plate systems, we make it for half the money.
I need to understand that. Everyone is familiar pretty much with the standard solar panel.
Yeah.
They typically come in sizes like 1 by 4 feet or variations on that. They're putting out now, I don't know, anywhere from, 30 to 50 or 60 watts in that 1 by 4 foot panel.
The cell, these kind of cells have an efficiency of average 11%. After 3 years sunshine, it goes down to about 8.5%. So conversion of the sun's energy into electricity is very bad.
Renewable energy lab. And the people from NREL gave us this certificate, and it has an efficiency of 37.3%.
Which is about 300% greater than your standard solar panel that we see today.
That's correct. So this cell now absorbs the concentrated rays, and that is what people don't believe. We get almost 800 times, more than 800 times, of electricity out of a cell of the same size of a conventional.
You have to say that we concentrate the sun to 400x and have a cell which has a much higher efficiency. So our cell is only 1.5 by 1.5 centimeter large, and the per watt we have costs of $0.64, and in the one sun cells it's $4 to $5 per watt.
Now we will be able to compete in price. We are able to compete with coal-fired and oil-fired units.
The standard solar panel is about 1 by 4 feet or 1 by 3 feet, and they vary. If I were to take three of these, therefore it would be essentially 1 by 3 feet, what kind of energy production could we capture from that?
11% efficiency means from a square meter you get 110, theoretically 110 watts. In practice, it goes then down to 85 or so. In our case, a square meter has 300 watts. So that is a totally different dimension. And therefore, we get also per square unit of the plant much, much more. So if we compare with the largest solar plant in the world, that is in Daggett, that is Solar 2. We are 14.6 times better. But if we compare it with a chimney type of power plant, then we are 180 times better. We get 180 times more energy from the same acre of ground.
That's dramatically significant. A lot of people complain because in traditional forms, you have to have huge arrays in order to produce effectively solar. So that if we're able to therefore concentrate this, we're able to use a much smaller collector to produce the same amount of energy, and then people start saying, well, that's practical. That's a reasonable solution.
So we need only a 16th of space if we compare it with solar one.
Well, that's a huge step forward. Now, is it going to cost more for your system, or the same, or less than traditional?
The silicon cell per watt is almost 1,100 grams. Ours is 0.076 grams. That is 14,000 times less. The next one is a very important figure. That is, how much energy do we get per square centimeter? The conventional cell brings 0.011 watt per square centimeter. Ours, 13.6 watt per square centimeter. That means 1,236 times more. The same cell. Now comes the price per watt. We are much cheaper. 5 times, 6 times, 7 times cheaper than cells today. The important thing is, if you have the same surface of cell, we are 1,236 times better. That means we get 1,236 times more electricity as the conventional silicon cell.
When we return, we visit a working demonstration of the Pyron solar generator here on the Wild Side News.
Well, I'm standing in front of the... How do you like to refer to this system?
Oh, that's a Pyron power plant.
Okay. This would be a Pyron power plant, and it's actually sitting in like a large wading pool, which is about, oh, I don't know, the water here is probably about 18 inches, maybe 20 inches.
Yes.
But I understand it could actually be even less than that.
Yeah, 18 centimeter would be enough.
Now, how many do you call these collectors, the individual units, what do you refer to them as?
Modules. So the modules, 10 modules fill one trough. As you see in the middle, they are all the same. And in each module has a lens with and a secondary optic and a cell and obviously the cooling device. It's all integrated in a little tube.
Yes, and so this whole system floats on the tank. It's how wide is that? Give it, and it's best if you could talk in terms of feet. Some of the audience doesn't understand meters so well.
23 feet diameter, and it rotates on a swimming tube. So very, very simple, and with almost no friction, and a very little motor. It is a motor with only less than 1 watt, drives this according to the azimuth of the sun, and the troughs are tilting around in vertical axis for the elevation of the sun.
Right, and that actually changes very slowly, that elevation changes.
Oh, yes. So in the elevation is in the morning visible, and then it goes slow, and at noontime it reaches zero, and then it goes the opposite way.
Well, I think one of the things that is so extraordinarily elegant about the system is the fact that the total servo mechanism to control this array, which, and how many actual modules are there in this array?
288.
There's 288 modules in this array. Is controlled by a total of 3 watts worth of energy consumption, which is nothing. Just that alone is an incredible efficiency right there.
The solar tracker and set has two systems. One guides the azimuth motor that is here, this little tire, and the other one, the elevation.
Yeah, this array that has 200 and some modules on it is a big. It's like a big wheel. It's a big, looks like aluminum or something wheel that floats, and then each one of the collections of modules. How do you refer to a stack of modules?
That is a trough, and in a trough are 10 modules.
In its largest.
In the middle, there are. In large units, you have more or less only the long ones.
And anyways, all of these literally float on the water, and therefore the entire system can easily rotate. There's just one, it's a wheelbarrow tire, for all intents and purposes, that just drives the entire system to track the sun as it moves from east to west throughout the day. And quite honestly, if I may say so, it's brilliant.
Here is a propeller from an ultralight aircraft, and the propeller is driven by a DC motor, and the DC motor is driven by a part of the troughs. So it's very noisy, but yes. It indicates how much energy we produce.
Now, this particular array could produce how many watts?
6,600 watts. So 6.6 kilowatt, yes.
And that, of course, would be during sun time.
Yeah, that is at noontime. In the early morning it is less, in the late afternoon it is less too. Not much, no.
Well, that's an incredible advantage right there, because in typical flat solar panels, you get a terrific drop-off in the mornings and the evenings.
So that we get all the energy, all the radiation of the sun that touches this system 100% into the cell.
Now, have you been able to determine, let's say if this was in production, a unit like this, what the actual cost to a consumer might be?
We believe that we are around $2 per watt. That means $2,000 per kilowatt. That is much, much, much less than the today's systems. They cost $6,500 or $8,000. The Solar 2 has even cost $22,000.
So, just in terms of practical, if I were to buy this, if I were to say, I want to buy this, how much would it cost me? I'm talking about it when you're in actual production, not this one, but you understand.
Yes, and you have to pay for each kilowatt, $2,000, for 6 kilowatt, $12,000. And then you have, for 25 years, electricity.
What would you estimate in terms of the number of homes, for example, a unit like this might power?
A normal house requires continuous load from about 950 watts, except you switch on the air conditioner and then it jumps up to 4 kilowatt. So
air conditioner 2, otherwise 6 houses.
And of course that's using these ancient devices. And you know, the whole trick to this future is to now inspire new devices that are much more energy efficient and integrate that. We need to integrate these systems.
Yeah, we certainly have to change the whole system to low energy consumers. but we think we are on the way.
So a person invests their, we'll say, $12,000 in a unit like this, and in terms, now of course you haven't had a chance to really test this out for 25 years, but what would you say would be the maintenance on a unit like this?
There's very, very, very little, because it is all very safe, and the only necessity is for this system to clean the lenses, but the new systems have a spray bar, and so they are automatically cleaned every evening.
Well, I sure like this better than I do great big huge wind-driven propeller generators that really I think are not that attractive in the landscape.
And this makes no noise and doesn't pollute.
And actually, in terms of moving parts, it's the simplest moving parts I've ever seen in my life.
That's right. So that is a very important advantage of our system, that we have practically no precision mechanics. These are all ball bearings from plastic, and they don't require lubrication, nor do they wear, because we move them only once a day, 60 degrees in one direction, then backwards 60 degrees in the other direction.
Very, very impressive. Very impressive.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We continue our story on this breakthrough in solar technology that will lead to a serious alternative sustainable energy future for us and for the world. What's it going to take? Listen.
Well, again, John and Inga Lang, we continue our conversation, and I've had a chance to look at the your system, and if I had to give an analysis, I'd say I think you've got yourself an amazingly interesting new technology. And I congratulate you for the elegance of the design and the breadth of the application, you know. So here's the real question then. It seems as if to me this is a technology that is ready to actually go into production.
Yes, it is intended also to continue. We started a little production already for the high-tech parts, but we have to invest in the rigs and tools for the low-tech units, because it is intended that we get only coils of aluminum and build the troughs and the material at the site, so that we have no transport problems.
So far, we could do it on our own, but now we also need help. Financial help and manpower.
Well, that's called investment. So let's say that investment came in. How long would it be before this became at least initially operational?
The very first one would be after maybe 5-6 months, but in real production requires a year.
Now, your vision really is not to limit production to just San Diego, but really to be able to make this available to the world.
Yeah, we are looking for franchisees all over the world, and we will always supply the high-tech parts, the lenses, and the conduit with cell, and the low-tech parts will be done in the country on the site. And we will train franchisees and deliver the necessary tools and jigs.
It seems to me, as I look at this, that it's a good strategy in the sense that the high-tech parts are very small, and that the low-tech parts are very big and relatively easy to manufacture and assemble.
That's right. It's easy to make them, so they could be made in any place in the world, but they are labor-intensive. Therefore, the price will be depending from the labor cost in the country where the site is built.
So let's say a year or two from now, you're actually in production. What would be the application? Let's talk first of all, for example, in the United States. How might this affect homes, neighborhoods, towns, and cities?
The first approach is end of the line unit. That means the lines going far away from the power plant can feed the clients, but as soon as the sun comes, as it gets hot, then the average consumption of 950 watts goes up to 4 kilowatt, and that is then too much for the system, and therefore they need on the end of the line, of the end of the power grid, they need solar power, and that is coincides with sunshine and hot and need of air conditioning, yes.
It isn't just a matter of producing electricity. You're also very interested in utilizing these systems as a source to efficiently produce hydrogen, which certainly is part of the future. And I think that's a very important aspect of this as well, that it becomes a very transportable, efficient way of creating hydrogen.
We don't only want to produce hydrogen by electrolysis, but also hydrogen and oxygen, so that we can produce electricity overnight when we don't have sun.
Magneto hydrogen dynamic system is an old, well-known principle, but it never worked with air, because air contains 70% of nitrogen, and the nitrogen is a ballast, is well without value, but it has to be heated up, and therefore they never reached with systems in the operation the high efficiency. We are the only one who can recombine hydrogen with oxygen, and then we get temperatures far, far above 3,000 centigrade, even above 3,300 centigrade.
There is the rudimentary form, which is what we've been talking about, which are the solar arrays that would produce electricity and or be utilized to produce hydrogen. And it gets rather technical at this point, so at some point I think what people need to do is to visit the website and or contact John and Inga to understand that this is just the tip of the iceberg, really, in terms of what is possible in utilizing a full arena of not only the production but also what we might call the waste energy, because there is a lot of other heat and other things that are available in this process that can be converted through a rather elegant plasma technology that has secondary and tertiary opportunities for serious energy production.
So we will make use from existing generators and will feed them with our oxygen and with our hydrogen in the stoichiometrically right ratio. That is 2-to-1, and therefore we have the possibility to produce the hottest flame on Earth. The hottest flames that are highly dissociated into negative carriers and positive carriers of electricity. And this electricity is the second possibility to make a huge quantities night electricity.
Well, as I say, that particular technology is one that deserves almost another show and becomes very technical, but it's really thrilling. I have a mild understanding of what we're talking about. So, John, how would this technology compare? There are a lot of efforts at solar, but you really see the potential for this to become much more than just solar power, but actually solar generating systems for whole communities.
We could produce electricity for whole countries if we have desert space available, and we have the sun and we should use it. We also can use it for smaller communities, but it has no limit size, so we can put it in any size.
It has the potential to substitute coal burning and oil burning, and the possibility would be that in a very short time it could feed very large areas to substitute the whole electricity consumption of the United States. Requires desert area from 30 by 30 kilometer. These areas are available in west of America.
That's a very hopeful vision. Very hopeful vision. On a little different angle, John, what drives these ideas? Is it strictly your background in physics and a desire to invent, or are there other things that drive your mission to bring this technology to the world, which you just have done and you are about ready to launch?
It's very difficult to say. Number one, it is necessary that new energy will be created, will be made available for the public. But number two is we developed in 22 years all the basic elements, and now we are ready to start production of these power plants that can substitute existing coal-fired and oil-fired units.
Inga, I can sense that you actually have quite a passion for nature and the environment.
I think it's impossible that we don't use the sun when we can, and instead we do something to hurt our environment, and I hate it, and I also hate it when all the trees are gone, and when this terrible storm was in Haiti, the damage was only so big because there were no trees left. In the neighboring country, the Dominican Republic, they had trees. There was no damage. Why do we do this? Same rain, but no damage, because they still had their forests, and we should protect the environment.
Where did the name pyron come from?
Pyrolytic means made by high temperature. So conversion by super high temperature. That was the basis of pyron.
It's hard to know what can happen and what is possible, but it certainly seems as if there is a technology available here that the world should know about. And I'm glad that I can bring this to the world on the Wild Side News. John and Inga, if people wish to learn about your technologies, how can they do so? We may have people who are interested from anywhere in the world.
Email or website. Our email is pyroninc@aol.com. Our website is pyronsolar.com.
It's up to you, all of you, and us. Please contact John and Inga if you want to invest your hopes and more in your future. When we return, it's off to the woods, the big woods, the redwoods of Muir Woods National Monument, as we continue the story of the Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.